You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 91. On the last show, we visited the Historic New Orleans Collection in the French Quarter. Curator and artist Jan Gilbert took us on a tour of the newest exhibit entitled Art in the City, Postmodern to Post-Katrina. It's sponsored by the Hellas Foundation, and the exhibit's a great way to explore New Orleans past and present through our art. I had a great time with Jan, and I know you'll enjoy the discussion too. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. Today's episode is about a curious collection of newspapers and what they might tell us about the past. Before we dive into that discussion, though, I want to tell you about two of our sponsors. First up is Two Chicks Walking Tours. If you're a regular listener to the show, you've heard me talk about their wonderful Garden District tour. Today, I want to tell you about their Brothels, Bordellos, and Ladies of the Night tour. Brothels is a nighttime tour that sheds some light on an element of the dark past of the city, but does it with respect, sass, and a whole lot of fun research to back it up. It starts close to the river and winds to the back of the French Quarter. It's currently offered on Fridays and Saturdays, and it'd be a great choice if you want to learn more about Storyville and the people who worked there. Two Chicks also offers tours of St. Louis Cemetery No. 1 and the Garden District. Whatever you choose, know you're going to be in great hands and you'll have a wonderful time. Use code BEYOND and save 15% at twochickswalkingtours.com. Lots of you have reached out to me about moving to New Orleans. If you've gotten the bug, you need a good realtor, and that's where Liz Wood comes in. Let Liz and her team over at Liz Wood Realty help you find the right place, whether you plan to rent or purchase the home of your dreams. New Orleans is a great city, but choosing the neighborhood that's the best fit for you can be overwhelming. Liz makes the process fun and easy. Uptown, downtown, by the lake or near the river, mid-city, the 9th Ward, Liz and the team can help you sort it all out. Reach out to her at lizwoodrealty.com and make your dream of living in New Orleans a reality. Several members of our community have already done just that, and they're thrilled with their new homes. You will be too. All right, let's jump into the discussion. As I mentioned earlier, today's episode is about the past. Well, sort of. It's a story of forgotten treasures, the British Library, a printer, maybe even some Nazis. Intrigued? I am too, so let's get to it. My guest today is a writer, a printer, and a self-described media archaeologist. Welcome to the podcast, Joseph. How are you?
Pretty great.
Good. It's good to have you here. Thank you for inviting me into the warehouse.
Yeah, it's good to have you here as well, in sort of like the shape of it all.
So when you first reached out to me, gosh, it was almost a year ago. A lot's changed since then. But we want to get into the collection and what's it about. But let's first talk about you a little bit. So did you grow up here in New Orleans, or where did you grow up?
No, I actually grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay.
Yep. I found my curiosity antiquity running around my father's antique shops as a kid. And that's sort of the world I came from. My first job, actually, my first paid job, aside from working for my dad, was actually a paper boy. When I inherited my brother's paper route, when I was about, actually, probably the summer before I turned 13, I was already jumping on the paper route and slinging papers on my bike. But I grew up in Cleveland in that world, and got into writing and poetry as a young person. I was actually the editor-in-chief of my high school newspaper.
Really?
So yeah, so I have this, and I was involved with the newspaper during high school. So strangely enough, there's this theme of newspapers throughout my life in antiquity and writing and literature. You know, someone asked me recently if I sort of had aspirations to be a journalist myself. And I think that was a really good question, being sort of like an accidental archivist of decades of journalism. I think as the more and more I look at journalism of the past, it makes me realize that it's a lot different than journalism of today.
Sure.
And I think my work as a journalist, so to speak, is a little bit different. And I think it's more about finding the connections between the past and the present, mm-hmm. especially the ones that people aren't really thinking about, or if you don't have access to 30,000 tubes full of historic newspapers, you wouldn't really know. And the truth of the matter is I don't always know what I'm looking for either.
Sure.
So when I'm over here at the archive some days and I'm going through a new stack of tubes to sort them into chronologies or different collections we have over here, it's really surprising what will uncover, what is uncovered and what will show itself.
Sure. Well, I can't wait to get into some of that. But so how did you get from Cleveland to New Orleans?
Yeah, how did I get to Cleveland?
Yeah.
So I did a program through the University of New Orleans. I was enrolled in school here since 2013.
Okay.
And I was fortunate enough to do this program, and it was a low residency Master's of Fine Art in Creative Writing. And the director at the time was sort of like my, sometimes I say he's my mentor, but he's not really my mentor. He's like my anti-mentor, meaning like he does different things than I do, but I do the things that I do because he does the different things.
So sure, it's like, it's complimentary. Like,
so, but Bill Lavender, publisher and poet in town, about town, and he was director of the program at then. So I was actually doing this MFA as a low res. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't living in New Orleans, but I was traveling a lot during those 2 or 3 years, and I was getting to go to Europe every summer and meeting these New Orleanians that would be coming from here to go and do their study abroads in Europe. And so I spent 3 summers in Europe earning my master's degree.
Okay.
Yeah, and then I would do correspondence work and online work during the regular semesters. And it was one of the only programs at the time that kind of had really mastered the online learning system through UNO.
Okay.
So when Katrina hit, they were actually seminal in keeping people online taking classes during sort of the recovery. So it was something that, you know, I got to do this distance program. And then after I graduated in the spring of 2006, the class of only three, there's only three of us that graduated that semester. And I came here and I was just... you know, had just said, I'm going to make it a goal of mine to move here. And so then I moved here, spent a couple summers working some jobs in the French Quarter. And then I ended up here working some art studios downtown. And then eventually I got hired at Delgado doing the sling, the hard 5 courses a semester, teaching 100 plus students, grading 500 papers. And I just put my head down and really I did that for 5 years straight. And that was sort of like, my loss of innocence of New Orleans during that time period. Yeah,
that's awesome.
So that bit brought me here is like I got my degree and then ended up here.
Yeah,
post degree.
So that happens to a lot of kids that get enamored of New Orleans and find a way back.
Find a way back, indeed. Yeah.
So that's great. So we're happy that you did. And so then you're kind of moving along in your career, and you're also doing some print work and some one-off work.
Yeah, I had come from Cleveland, where I had established a printing press and a small press publisher. Sort of like seeing the way that books were made differently, and not just sort of like a perfect bound CreateSpace Amazon produced book, but I wanted something a little bit more tactile, something more beautiful, something with a letterpress cover, something with special paper, something with special inserts. So I was really interested in that. And as an undergrad at UMass Amherst, I got really lucky and I pulled a job off the work study board. And I marched right over to the office where the job was, where they were hiring, and I got a job for 2 years as an undergrad at UMass Press in the design and production department of their book publishing company. And I got to do for those last 2 years of college, I just had like this part-time job up there where I was learning everything I possibly could with the design and production, two people and me. And like the grad student who they had every semester was under me. I was actually like one of the people there, but I had learned a thing called Adobe PageMaker. Oh my God, I'm dating myself.
Right.
And then like all this and like a Quark Express, like all these old programs for designing books and publications. And I learned all that, and I learned how to scan things. But because I had done the stuff in high school, I was able to translate that experience of working on the newspaper into working on the press. So I got all this experience doing design work, and I sharpened my skills in design. I never took design classes, but it was this alternate thing that I had going, the paper boy, working in the newspaper, writing for the newspaper, editing the newspaper, and then working in the press. So
right.
I had this sort of alternate education aside from my regular education.
So
making books, and as a teacher at Delgado, I was really interested in producing and making books and all this. I got really curious about these shops in New Orleans that were these old print shops. And after Katrina, they were all over, because New Orleans is the kind of city, and there's other towns like this, cities like this, but in the 80s and 90s was sort of the end of the mom and pop print shops. They used to be every neighborhood used to have one. And same with New Orleans. There was one, there was like Artvertising, and then there was the Laborde shop on Frenchman. So right. I sort of met these old time printers, and they kind of tipped me off as to like, oh yeah, there's a bunch of these old print shops. You should go and find a directory, pre-Katrina directory, and start calling around to see if there's any of these equipment or materials and things. So I was starting to get into these old print shops at Laborde on Frenchman Street is like this big story where I got all this stuff out of there, and it was like archives and letterpress type and printing presses and old vintage paper and big light tables and foil stamp machines and just cool things that were there that I knew what to do with them. And it was like, again, the situation, and you know how this was, it was just dumpsters were just getting full of stuff.
Sure, sure.
And it was very indiscriminate how stuff was being gotten rid of after Katrina. And a lot of stuff went, you know, to the scraps. Like I had heard this sad, sad story of like the Franklin printing building downtown where there's like the hotel is in there now. I can't remember which hotel it is. Maybe the Wyndham. But that building on like the third floor of it, it was like the largest type collection of the entire South.
Really?
And it got dumpstered after Katrina. Like this guy was telling me how big it was. He was like, man, it was almost the entire floor was just compositors. And it was where they sat to compose all the, it was like the Huey Long owned newspaper or Huey Long operated newspaper back then. It was like, they had all of it was still there, like up on the third or fourth floor.
Sure.
And it just got just gone, you know, like that type of insane amount of collections. Like, you know, so I started getting interested in printing equipment. The point is what I want to make. And just seeing vintage equipment and understanding, like, this is the last stuff like this that's going to show up. And you see, like, type cases in antique shops all the time.
Right.
It's like, oh, that's a thing. But you never really understand, like, what is in it. Or maybe you see some picture blocks. And you say, that's a cool printing block. You don't really understand what it does or how it functions in a press. And so I started finding this stuff all around town and buying up printing presses and trying to save and salvage. So in the shop here, you'll see, you know, paper punches and book binding material machines and letter presses and type cases and vintage paper and binding equipment and all this sort of stuff. It's related because it's, oddly enough, from the same time period as the newspaper archive.
Sure.
It's print.
So that's a good
archaeology.
That's a good segue of. So now we jump forward to about 2013.
Yeah.
And you are perusing Craigslist?
Yeah, I'm still at Delgado. I'm still teaching. It's like one of my last years teaching over there. And I'm just like sort of cruising Craigslist. And I'm like, I'm checking for antiques and printing presses. And I'm always looking for stuff. But by the way, I saw that ad that morning. And I immediately sent it off. But when I saw it, I knew what it was already because there was an ad the previous summer to sell these papers off for X many dollars each, and they were trying to sell them. And I remember seeing this ad. I remember making a call or sending a couple emails, a little correspondence. So when I sent that message that morning to find out to inquire about the archive and what was going to happen with it, I got a phone call like an hour later.
And so what did the ad say? Do you remember?
It was like in the antique section. It wasn't in the free section.
Uh-huh.
I think it's been reported that it was in the free section, but it was actually in the antique section for like newspaper archive looking for home or something like that. It was like a new historic newspaper archive or something like that. And it was just like sort of like showed a few pictures of the tubes and it didn't really fully explain the volume of it, gravitas of the collection. And you have to understand, like, these were put into airtight plastic tubes and archival mylar, so they painstakingly protected this archive for Louisiana weather and climate, and it must have taken months upon months to do this. And when I walked into that building, you know, I answered the call. I said, oh, well, maybe I could come tomorrow. And the person was like, no, can you come right now? Like, it was very much like, we need a plan for this, you know? So I got on my bike. I had to teach. I remember like this day specifically, I had to teach like a 1 o'clock class. It was like 11 o'clock. And I'm thinking, oh my God, can I bike all the way from because I live by where Bacchanal is. Can I bike all the way from that corner of the city all the way to Tulane and like Loyola or like, and then can I meet with this person and then make my 1 o'clock class at Delgado? Like, that's literally what I had in my, you know, my mind was like, oh my. So I had to like, I got a flat tire on the way. I was like almost there. I had to walk a few blocks. I met with this person, sort of like was like flabbergasted that I'm like looking at this archive, seeing what it is. I realized what it is. I said, this is such an important thing. And like then being put on the spot, like they're trying to get me to agree to take it and make a plan like immediately. and I'm like worried about my class and I have a flat tire and I'm like, oh my God, like, this moment. And I said, okay, made a couple calls, arranged for some storage and said, okay, we're going to make this happen. We're going to do it. Cause I just thought in that moment.
And so was it
was fate.
Almost. Was it in a warehouse or in a home?
It was in a storefront.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just a storefront that you never know what's behind the wall of a storefront.
Of
so
course.
Like if it's like papered over, like 15 of these tubes were in a box and it was like a whole stack up. It was boxes, floor to ceiling, all the way back.
So we'll take some pictures and we'll put them over. Sure. The show notes for today's show will be over at beyondbourbonst.com/91. But what you're describing are sort of these clear cylinders with red caps on either end, and there's a newspaper in each one.
Yeah. And there's Mylar. When you pull the newspaper out, you can handle it and open it. You can open it up because there's Mylar.
I see.
Encasing sort of like
but
the paper.
The collection is approximately 30,000 newspapers. Is that
right? As far as we know, it's about 42 years. You know, it goes 1888 to 1929. So I have other parts of the collection too. The other parts of this of my collection that go further beyond 1930, but for the most part, the archive itself stops.
So you walk into this warehouse that's packed floor to ceiling with this collection of New Orleans-based newspapers, original
tubes,
papers from the 1880s?
I mean, I didn't really, like, you,
right.
have to
you just walk
like,
into
I
this
really
massive wall of
time,
paper.
Because I open up a box, pull a tube out, I see a comic, I'm like, this is really cool, put it back in, walk a few more down, open up another box, pull a tube out, see something really boring from the 1890s. It doesn't really have a lot of graphics on it. It's like, okay, what's this? Then go to another thing, and then it's 1920s magazine section with blue printing. So, like, at first it was, like, hard to understand really what it was.
Sure.
You know, so after I sort of got it and secured it, it was sort of like a year of living in Christmas morning. As a paper fetishist. As someone who's, like, already into printmaking equipment and paper and making books, and it's sort of like, oh, my God. Like, what is this? What is it? And it took a while to really understand. And then a friend of mine had tipped me off, said, hey, you need to read this book by Nicholson Baker called Doublefold. And I did. And I realized that this archive actually figures into the story exactly.
So,
because Nicholson Baker had bid on this archive.
Really? So let's tell people very briefly what Doublefold is.
So Doublefold is this book written by this author. He writes fiction too, but he wrote this monograph, this like book about sort of the history of microfilm and what how it came to be, what the process was, what the science behind it was, who the people behind it was, and then as he's writing this book about microfilm, it just turns out that the British Library is happening to it just so happens that they're deaccessioning their entire American newspaper archives at the exact time. And he was basically talking about, like, well, what does it take to really preserve paper like this? And then what are they really doing when they microfilm it? And then what's lost? So all this sort of, those themes sort of come through it. And it's pretty clear, okay, so this sort of dovetails into Baker's book in a couple different ways. This is a sort of like figures into it because he bid on this archive because he knew that the pecune was worth saving.
And so about what time frame is this roughly?
He's writing this in like the late 90s.
Okay.
98,
and at some point he becomes aware that this archive that you and I are now surrounded by is being deaccessioned from the British Library.
Yeah, but this was just one piece of a larger collection.
Sure.
And Baker was really focused on saving the New York World, the Joseph Pulitzer grand opus of Joseph Pulitzer's entire career, is like the world. And it was this incredible newspaper that just broke the boundaries of the column in so many amazing ways. And it has color in the 1890s. You know, the newspaper wars are fought between Hearst and Pulitzer because of this type of, you know, because of a com, you know, because of the Yellow Kid and the poaching of the comic artist. And all, like, sort of like, this is like the making of America.
Sure.
You know, like this era where it goes from the smoking man's newspaper, like the upper middle class or upper class elitist kind of like reporting on that, and then bringing it down to like talking about like real people and real life situations and the basic things and the street stories, and really bringing it into an industrial product for the common people.
Sure.
That's what the newspaper became. It wasn't always like that. I think like maybe like different things like Harper's Weekly and stuff like that was a little bit more it was for the learned people, people who could read and write.
Sure.
In the Civil Wars, a lot of people couldn't read and write. So even that was a little bit more upper class. But this is like a specific era of newspaper, like the 1880s. I tell people, like, oh, our archive goes from the stock. I say our archive goes from the cotton exhibition to the stock market crash.
Right, right.
And it goes through this changes of things like this. It's the golden age of illustration. It's the Belle Epoque. Mm-hmm. It's the beginning of photographs. It's the beginning of aviation. It's the beginning of macro and micro photography. It's the beginning of automobiles. It's the beginning of newspapers as industrial product. It's the beginning of so many things in that era. The end of Reconstruction, a little bit after the end of Reconstruction, into the Great Depression.
So Baker's obviously aware of this. He tries to bid on this collection or this in, as part of a collection.
Yeah, and this went to a different guy.
Sure.
There was a newspaper dealer in Pennsylvania who bought like 6 shipping containers full of historic American newspapers.
But it wasn't the first time that this collection was in danger, right? Because that gets us to the...
Well, what happened was it was in a warehouse. So this was in the British Library's possession from literally when it was published till 1999 and or 2000, something like that. And it was actually in a warehouse during World War II that was bombed by the Nazis. And they thought it was a munitions plant, and they dropped a bomb on this warehouse. And I believe it actually, the bomb hit the side of the warehouse where the British and Irish newspapers were. And they lost thousands of volumes, but it didn't affect the American collection.
Yeah. So it ends up eventually in Pennsylvania.
Finding its way back to Pennsylvania. And then a real estate investor, rare books person purchases it and brings it back to New Orleans.
And so then it's back in New Orleans. You end up with it. And you've mentioned it's sort of the golden era of newsprint. But let's talk a little bit about, you know, you mentioned the time period, but it really also encompassed essentially 3 newspapers, right?
It does, yeah. You have, you know, we just had a really interesting merger. So yeah, in 1914, what happened was is the Picayune was bought out by the Times Democrat, and that's the Phelps. That's where sort of the lineage or the beginning of the Phelps family comes in, and that's where, you know, the political voice. The reigning political voice of the time was more controlled by the Times Democrat, and it was a stronger paper in general. The legacy of Eliza Jane Nicholson, sort of coming off of 1896 when she dies, her sons are really young and they take it over. But really, it's like a board of directors that's running it. It's sort of the natural progression of Eliza Jane's legacy of being like a. If she would have lived longer, she would have seen photography come in the paper. She would have seen, you know, this merger of media and how that works. But I think like what we see into the turn of the century before we sort of lose our innocence in World War I, you know, there's a different sense of awe and wonder pre-World War I, and it changes. And that's what like that era from like late 1890s into World War I is like a real special era. So that's like as the Picayune's aging, it becomes a literary paper, a family. There's like needlework patterns in it. There's like all this like women's advice column, like Dorothy Dix is started under the reign of Eliza J. Nicholson. And she has a women's advice column for like 50 years, you know?
So I'm going to interrupt you for
a moment.
Yeah,
sorry. Yeah. I don't want to spiral out.
Let's tell the listeners about who is Eliza Jane and what's her significance to this story.
Yeah, Eliza Jane's significance to the story is like this, like I said, this archive is sort of like her legacy in a certain way, because it's mostly the meat and potatoes of what she was able to do with the papers. And she was a sort of upper middle class, born in Pearlington, Mississippi, just over the border, really. And she kind of came from this like country family, but upper class, but she was a poet. And then she started getting published in little journals and newspapers around the country. And then she got published in New Orleans. And then she came to New Orleans to visit her uncle and met people at the paper. And they let her be the literary editor of the paper really young. And that was like a little bit scandalous for like a young woman to be working in the newspaper industry for her family, and they didn't really approve of it, but she stayed. And then she gets married in a sort of scandalous way. I mean, not really too scandalous, but like the Colonel Holbrook, who owned the paper at the time, divorces his wife and then marries Eliza Jane a couple years later. And then he dies, and then she gets the paper.
And so which paper does she, at this point, she's the editor and the publisher of the Picayune.
She gets to be the publisher of the Picayune. And actually, for the first few years of her stead as the publisher and owner of the Picayune, it was embroiled, and there was a lawsuit because the previous owners sued for it, and they didn't get it. Hmm. So I was embroiled in a lawsuit, and then but she won it eventually and got it, and then it wasn't until about 1880 when she began to really ramp up her vision for the paper. And that's when she that's when they start to bring in things like they get the illustrator L.A. Winter Halder to do the weather frog, and to and they do they bring in, like I said, like the Elizabeth Gilmer Merriweather becomes Dorothy Dix. It's like her neighbor who she becomes good friends with. And then they sort of like create this persona. And then she writes this advice column goes. And then there's like the society page, the society bee comes in. Of course, at first, the uptown elites were kind of like, don't write about us in the paper. We don't want to be written about. And then after a few months of that, they're like, oh, we want to be in the paper because it like, you know, it like makes us like popular.
So I want to stop you there. You mentioned in passing the weather frog. So sure. Let's explain to the listeners, the weather frog actually carried through until probably now or very recently in the Times-Picayune. So what is the weather frog?
It did get phased out one time. I don't know if they brought it back maybe recently or maybe they brought it back at some point, but it did get phased out like in this era because there's a little duck drawn by this other guy. And it's like duck ditties. So the weather frog gets phased out and the duck ditties kind of pops
up. But for our listeners, so the weather frog, like, gosh, I can remember.
It was basically like a meteorology column.
Right. It would show the forecast for the day or the week and it would have this little frog.
Yeah, it would have a little frog doing different things.
I didn't realize it went that far back. I remembered it from my childhood, which obviously doesn't go that far back.
Yeah, maybe they brought it back. Yeah. So maybe it was resurrected. But I know that it was phased out in the 20s and 30s and maybe it came back like, you know, at some point.
So these two papers merge.
Yep, the Democrat and the Picayune merges. And, you know, a similar thing happens that just happened. The Democrat buys the accounts, the name, and basically absorbs the staff and makes a bigger, better paper.
Sure.
And they essentially, the Picayune print shop dies at that point. The Picayune, one of the deaths of the Picayune, we have one. It's 1914. And that's when, you know, some of the people, again, like join and some of them leave and work for other papers and so on and so forth. But that's definitely like a very similar merger.
So let's fill in our listeners a little bit. As we record this in May of 2019, The Advocate, which is a paper first based out of Baton Rouge, but then the New Orleans Advocate, competing paper with what until very recently was called the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com. The Advocate buys out NOLA.com. And this just happened in the last, again, as we record this in late May, in the last month or so. So they buy out essentially the Picayune, and they immediately announce that they're going to terminate the paper and terminate the entire staff.
Yeah.
So presumably, hopefully, some of those folks, some of those journalists and the people in the back room, some of them will get hired, but many of them won't. And the Picayune, as we know it, will dissolve, although they will combine the mastheads in some form. And that's what has happened throughout history. So not only with the two papers you described, but then I think the third paper also mentioned in your collection is the States Item comes along.
There's some stuff that I have States Item.
And so the States Item, gosh, in my childhood, the Times-Picayune and the States Item merge. And then they combine mastheads. So
yeah, here's one from before the merger right here. The Daily City Item, the Daily States, the New Orleans Item, the New Orleans States, and then the States Item. So
we're looking we're looking at a paper from 1977.
And that says 100 years.
And it says 100 years in print at that point, and it kind of shows the progression. Yeah, we'll take a picture of that, and we'll put it up on the website for people to see. So you're right. In many sense, what you've captured or what's captured in this archive is sort of something that we see repeating itself. And also this theme you were talking about as we hit World War One and right before that, sort of the publishing wars and the way that media is presented starts to change with the colors and the cartoons and all these different things that are captured in this archive. And the same thing happens today as we shift to, before we came on, you and I were talking about different types of media. And here we are recording a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And both NOLA.com and The Advocate have very large online presences and are constantly looking for different ways to share news and artifacts. And yet we see the same thing happening back at the turn of the century in the period that this archive encompasses.
Yeah. And you know what does happen is that there is an advance in technology and in printing technology. So I think the Democrat had superior presses, and they had presses that could do color, and the Picayune did too. The Picayune, people don't know this, but there was like there's like Sunday magazines in the Picayune that go back to like 1905 that had like four full color like chromo litho covers, And as far as the broadsheet goes, like the big giant paper, color comes in 1913. And I know that seems incredibly unbelievable, but it does. And what happens in 1913, like right before America enters World War I, in any sort of effort, you know, it comes in, color comes in a big way. Like it comes in full color, like in 1930. That sounds like really
and
crazy.
And so that
right?
had to sort of be mind-blowing for people used to reading a newspaper that's essentially black and white or maybe a little bit of color here and there
yeah.
to getting full color images.
And ladies fashion at first. Ladies fashion and comics. And they're in full color. And then kind of what happens is that stuff is really sort of shows itself like at the beginning. And then it falls out. Hmm. It falls out during World War One. What happens is like the comics change to two color, where it's just like one color over another color. And that's it. You know, and so it's kind of like, okay, that's interesting. Okay. So I think maybe like the war effort, maybe who knows, like the dyes, maybe.
Or sure.
Something. I'm sure there's something to do with it. Is like
right rationing you know, something or for, resources.
Yeah, maybe like the you know they just have to print with basic inks or like make something up of their own. I don't know, how, but it, maybe it was just not affordable and it wasn't to. But then when they came out, the merger, and then when color first came out, it's graphic. It's bright. It's bold. You know.
So that might be a good segue to ask you about some of the particulars and interesting facets of the collection. But before we do that, we're going to take a quick break and hear a word from our sponsor. I want to tell you about the old Number 77 Hotel. It's a place I've recommended frequently. It's in a great location in the Warehouse District, just 3 blocks from the French Quarter. It's close to lots of great places to eat and drink, and it's near the streetcar lines, too. I love that they have a wide range of choices when it comes to rooms. Really something for everybody. They have these interior rooms for when you don't want any hint of daylight after a long night out. They also offer premium rooms and artist loft suites that are curated by local New Orleans artists. There's a ton of choices for a small hotel. And another thing I really love is that they support local artists and artisans by exhibiting their works and selling their products, including Sweet Olive Soapworks, Nola Boards, and Chop Industries, 3 businesses all owned by women and featured on this podcast in the past. Oh, and the hotel's pet-friendly, too. As if all that wasn't enough, they have an award-winning restaurant, Compare Le Pen. And besides great food, they have terrific cocktails. In fact, the bar is one of my favorite places to meet out-of-town listeners. The old Number 77 Hotel is located at 535 Chapultepec Street. Use code BBOLD77 when you book a room and save 25%. Plus, you get a little bit of lagniappe, a little something extra, in the form of a $10 credit at Tootlaw for coffee and stuff in the morning. All right, let's get back to our discussion. So we're about to get into the collection itself, and the couple more things you want to say about the merger of the newspapers.
Well, just something special here, and we can maybe take a picture of this, but check this out. This one, so this is like an April 12th, 1914, where you see the Times Democrat and the Daily Picayune as one masthead.
Right.
Okay. But this one, this is April 12th, right? So when you flip to this one here, which is April 27th, you see the Times Democrat is different, right? It's drawn different.
Right. They've changed it.
And look what's between the word Times and Democrat. Look at the difference between this dash and that dash.
So it's a different
typeset. Do you recognize
that? Like a tilde, almost.
That's the Nova Media Group symbol.
Oh, really?
That they use. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, interesting.
So we'll sometime take some pictures between of that April 12th, 1914 and April 27th, 1914, that's when that was created.
So for a lot of listeners, they'll have no idea. Cool, but huh? The NOLA.com staff that's listening will appreciate that. We'll take some pictures. We'll put that
pretty
again
cool, yeah.
Over at beyondbourbonst.com/91. That's very cool.
So sometime in there, and I have a bunch of these, and I could probably isolate exactly
sure.
when that transition happened, but just pretty cool stuff to look at. There was a couple months when there was both, in 1914, where both mastheads were there on the paper.
Right, and I remember, again, as a kid, when the Picayune and the States Item merged, it was kind of the same way, right?
Yeah.
Sometime in the 70s or 80s, it kind of did the same thing. But, you know,
80-ish, because I think here's a 1984 World's Fair where both on there.
So, and we just did an episode about the World's Fair.
Yeah.
So again, maybe we'll take a picture of that and share it with folks. But right, you can see the Times Picayune at the top and then the States Item right underneath it. So that evolution is kind of a, you know, that happens in the newspaper industry, like in so many industries. But one of the things that, so I want to talk a little bit now, if we can, Joseph, about just some of the, you had this span of time where so much happens in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So have you been able to, as you parse through this collection, do you come across things so like, The Titanic sinking was in there. World War I starts. Fashions change. Big and small. Are you able to sort of see as you're just going through and starting and trying to catalog over these years, do you start to see the big events of the world jumping out in the paper and how they're presented and covered?
Yeah, good question. There definitely are. I think something that you have to keep an eye on with this is that when we look back on history, we really want there to be one guy named Buddy who was or was not an alcoholic schizophrenic who invented a thing called jazz.
Mm-hmm.
It's not true. They were playing hot in the park. They were playing hot brass in the park for decades. You know what I mean?
Sure.
And like, it's never like when we look back, people a lot of times want some sort of truth to be like a eureka moment where something is invented.
Right.
And I just don't think it's that simple. So what I see in this archive is I see a city that is absolutely in love with itself from early on. I see a legacy of reporting of Central and South America, Central America and the Caribbean, a rich legacy. Because maybe you don't know this, but George Kendall, who founded the Picayune in 1827, sorry, you know, he went off and reported heavily on the Mexican-American War. But they literally created a system where he would write the dispatches, and he hired a trusted boy who rode those dispatches on horseback from city to city to city to city, and it took him 17 hours to ride like 100 miles.
Yeah.
Where then they would bring the dispatches to the boats that were waiting, and on the boats were type compositors setting the stories so that as the steamboats would go up the coast and land in New Orleans, like 3 days later, the dispatches would already be set in type. They would immediately come off the boats, go to the press room. It would be printed and then telegraphed to Savannah, and the news would be in D.C. or New York or Augusta or whatever, and it would be sent up. It would be like 2 weeks from when they were written on the battlefield to when they were published in New York newspapers.
Wow.
And that was revolutionary.
Sure.
And what they did is they actually developed the system and took collections to shorten that. And they funded this system so that they could be getting it in 10, it could be published in 7 days from the battlefields to New Orleans in 7 days. And that was revolutionary news telling of the time. And it involved Pony Express riders, and it involved this elaborate system that was set up.
Sure.
And nobody could scoop the Picayune. The Picayune had this thing. It was like nobody could scoop them. The only way they could stop the Picayune from reporting is they would get those guys that would be waiting for the, they would get those type guys to get, they would get them drunk or something. So they, you know, they
slow them down.
Yeah, they would slow them down somehow. But
right.
So there's a legacy in this newspaper of reporting in Central and South America and Mexico. So I see an international paper in this time. I see a really interesting international paper that has a real look at South America that's different. Yes, it covered world news and events, but it was a little bit more. We talk about it being the northernmost capital of the Caribbean.
Right.
This right here shows that.
I see.
There's a lot of that world reporting, and there's a lot of hyperlocal stuff too. But it's you'd think that the big events to us in retrospect, there's like these hallmarks that happen.
Right.
But as I'm going through the archive, it's events are reported the way they're reported. And sometimes maybe they're reported in other newspapers bigger than it maybe was here. So like you say that, like, for example, like the Titanic, I haven't found the Titanic paper
yet. Interesting.
I don't know if that's even in this collection. Like maybe it got pulled out before I got to it. I don't know. Or maybe it got pulled out in England. Who knows?
Right.
But like, I haven't seen that paper yet.
Sure.
I've seen papers talking about the aftermath of the Titanic for sure. But I haven't like just seen like that big bold headline, you know, whatever. And I've seen other stuff. I've seen like the beginning of World War I, and I've seen other battles and other like the Lusitania and other things, but not necessarily like you want to think that there's like a big transition at 1900 or there's a big transition at 1920. And yes, those are important transitions, but the ebb and flow of the design and the look of the newspaper sort of happens naturally other ways.
Well, I think that's really interesting that you sort of apply a 21st century bias to think about. But what you're really describing is that trends and things evolve over time, so there's not like a seminal moment. So there's a local writer here, right, James Karst, who's written extensively about the early days of jazz and Buddy Bolden that mm-hmm. you're referring to, and also about the history of the po' boy, which is something that I've covered on the podcast as well. And it turns out that in both of those cases, you sort of want this eureka moment, and it's not that clear, right? Yeah. And I imagine that you see a lot of that in the paper where there's probably a passing reference here and there to different things. And so that if I'm following you, you can sort of piece it out over time and kind of see how something was covered that was local. But it tends not to be this smoking gun that we sort of want to have.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely some smoking guns. You know, the smoking guns in the collection, I think, are like some more in your face parts of the history that I think like maybe aren't necessarily well known. There's a lot of Confederate stuff, and like this paper is essentially like a neo-Confederate paper, and there's a lot of like in a certain sense, you know, through the editorial, and I think mm-hmm. like. And I think so. There's like a lot of coverage of that, and there's like a lot of credence laid to that. And there's like this newspaper played some roles in like race baiting and race wars and the race riots and stuff. So the history of this paper isn't all like sing-songy great. It's not sure. like all like this like, yes, Eliza Jane was the first woman who ran a newspaper in America, and yes, she brought in all these amazing aspects of newspapering in the South and all these things. So there's multiple sides to the story. You know, like I say, like when we talk about the news, I say this is the news as it was told.
Sure, sure.
That I like saying that to people, like, oh, it's the news as it was told, because there's another newspaper out there that probably told the story differently. Or like, for example, the German papers or the Spanish or French language speaking papers of the time. The Germans, having come to New Orleans, they had a completely different enlightened perspective of their experience in New Orleans, and they're intuitive and they have a totally different mindset. When they're talking about their culture and the way that they view the city, they come at it with a different view, and it's almost more enlightened in a certain way, because maybe they have their sort of institutional memory of their community is different.
Sure,
because it goes back to a different time. It's sort of an advanced culture. I'm not saying America was an advanced culture, but there was a brutalness to America and a brutalness to New Orleans in that era too. And I think so. I think it's like there's a lot of different perspectives, and I think when we talk about where archives have come and what has been sort of done to destroy this history, unintentionally or for better or for worse, we talk about microfilm, and people don't really know, young people might not know microfilm, but you know, they photographed newspapers that were shrunk it down to be the size of a postage stamp. And then in the 90s, they're like, oh, we have to do something with this for the digital age. And they ran it through, scanned it at 72 DPI and blew it up again. So there was a shrinking down, and then a reduction, and then an expansion. And that essentially is loss of data. It's mm-hmm. loss of history. No color, no grayscale. Very, very challenging to page level optical character recognition on all that stuff, let alone the cool ads that are lost in there that we're not finding because there's nothing that's searching them for us.
Sure.
So like there's a lot left to be... And I know all the jazz historians that in my community have talked to me like far and wide about this, how there's so much left to be found in newspapers. I'm finding the word jazz and jazz occurring before the famous On Jazz and Jazzism 1918 article. I'm finding stuff before that. I'm finding things, and it's in the ads. It's in the minutiae. It's in the stuff mm-hmm. that it's in the stuff that 30 years ago, some of the people would be like, that stuff doesn't matter.
Right.
The ads don't matter. Like, I think that they really thought that way. Like, I think I had a librarian come to me after I presented once crying, like, we did our best. I'm sorry. It's so amazing what you're doing, but we did our best. And I've been a librarian for 40 years, and I know that it was it was destruction for preservation purposes. And we thought we were doing the right thing, and we got rid of all this stuff, and we shouldn't have. And a lot was lost. You know, I think colors, information, grayscales, data, and all that. You know, I'm going to show you some graphics, but there's some pretty remarkable large-scale photography in this archive and beautiful centerfolds and puzzle sections edited by Harry Houdini that are printed in red and rotogravures and Sunday magazines. And you're standing right in front of an original William Faulkner short story that he wrote in 1926, 1925. He was living in New Orleans when that got published. And that's like in the Picayune, you know, that's cool as heck.
That's amazing.
And so there's like all this really compelling stuff that's here. And it's almost like having it in this way. Yes, it's like less access, but in a way it's more access.
Well, and that's maybe a good segue. I want to talk to folks about what the NOLA DNA project is.
Sure.
So you created this because people are listening. And of course, we're in an audio medium, and we'll share again some pictures over at beyondbourbonst.com/91. But it's hard to feel what we feel in here. And so let's talk a little bit about what is the NOLA DNA project.
The idea behind NOLA DNA, it's sort of a concept around the archive and this sort of being like the proverbial DNA of the city, the makeup of the not just the people, but the stories of the people and locational presence in this archive too. Like, so it's like we have stories, we have locations, we have address shifts, and we have businesses come and go, and we have all this stuff. And like the idea is that an archive is an archive, but we can do so much more with it than just a physical archive or just some microfilm, reverse engineered microfilm. So I really founded NOLA DNA as like this idea that we could like bring together different things of the same time. Like I have a good friend, Reno Durrett, who is this postcard collector. I don't know if you ever talked to this guy. He's got like an amazing postcard collection. And it starts in the 1880s and goes all the way. Basically, he's kind of postcards changed their size in the 50s or 40s, in the 50s. So his collection kind of stops in the 50s or 60s. They get bigger. So that's when postcard collectors usually stop. But he has an archive of postcards that matches this archive. So it's from the 1880s into the 30s mostly. So imagine like sort of like taking all the things that were on the newsstand together.
Right.
The postcards, sure. The newspapers, the very little magazines, but some magazine stuff like the Sunday Illustrated Magazine, which was maybe separate on the stand than the newspaper. All those, bringing those disparate things together, and maybe some other sources too, some secondary source books and things like that. When you start to bring everything together, you start to see the helix of the DNA. When you start to put the printing presses next to the newspapers, next to the postcards, that's what would all be on the newsstand together, you know?
Sure.
So it's interesting to see like how you can weave together a different understandings of material culture of the time if you look at all the media together of the time. NOLA DNA is essentially the collection. The operations business is Intelligent Archives.
Mm-hmm.
And they're different things, but the Intelligent Archives is really the dashboard for projects and moving forward as of this year, 2019. And what that is, it's sort of like a vision on how it's a business that exists for the development of a new archives portal, a new way to take this amazing collection, and we're going to redigitize it from scratch, from the originals. And when we do that at higher resolution, natively bring in all the archive standards for the Library of Congress, the standards for metadata and the standards for locational page level scanning. And we're going to use that, and we're going to dovetail our project perfectly with that. So it's just going to be essentially developed through that system. And we're going to create a brand new search tools for this across the whole collection. So it's not just going to be what everyone, what researchers deal with now, which are Boolean search phrases based on the optical character recognition page level OCR. We're going to be able to do different things, and the technology really just got here, meaning the scanning technology is better than ever. The OCR and all that's better than ever. The ability to do all this every step of the chain, along with machine learning and artificial intelligence, which can be applied to this project in so many different ways, whether we're going to geotag it or whether we're going to say, you know, show us every image of a chicken
right. In
this archive. And then we can look at even the way the illustration styles were changed from 1880s through the 1920s, that information. And then along with other potential things, like I said, geotagging, doing historic geocartography about like a specific event. Like imagine taking like all the streetcar worker strike stuff, okay, and then taking that and dropping all those points and data in, we could start to develop sort of like a real-time story
sure.
of how that all went down based upon the newspaper accounts, or adding resolution and making these graphics better, or taking them and creating 3D models from them. There's a lot of things that can happen And we're trying to set this up to have a vision for 30 years into the future.
Sure. And so listeners, we'll put the links again in the show notes, but if you go to noladna.com, you can see a little bit of that and the beginnings of that and some discussions of that, as well as links to places where you've been interviewed and projects you're working on. But
yeah, you know, the way that we've been applying, and I feel like it's been a lot of proof of concept. I feel
sure.
like I've been challenged again and again. You're just like, oh, develop a proof of concept and bring that through.
Right.
And that is coming through. And that's like we're able to apply it to filmmaking, and we're able to apply it for museum archives, and we're able to apply it in ways for creating digital projects for the public. And I think we have a physical artifact. We have a potential for a lot of data.
Mm-hmm.
We have a little bit of, I want to be able to bring graphics back for people to use. I want to be able to open doors to new ways to search for genealogy related things. And then better research tools for scholars. And then we can maybe apply, maybe there's a way for us to take secondary source material and apply that directly in the system.
Sure. I mean, you and I talked before, last week, I think, when we first met face-to-face, of this idea of this paper is an archive on several different levels. And you've just kind of, this is what was fascinating to me in part. One, it's amazing to see it, but then to think about the data, the bits of data in there and all the different turns on that, whether it's an event and kind of searching for coverage of the event, or it's a style thing, like you're saying. Often it strikes me that not only in this collection, but in general, when we look back at things, it's the ads and the seemingly innocuous stuff that really tells us the most about it. Like you look back at, I don't know, magazines from the 70s, right? And you see the hairstyles and the clothes, and those are the things maybe you would have glanced right through in a magazine today. But when you look back 30 years or 50 years or 100 years, it's those things that really catch you, because it talks about the society at the time.
Yeah.
And what I love about what you're doing is by using technology today, you guys are going to be able to go in and harvest different things. So if you want to actually see a newspaper from 1900, you can do that. But if you want to explore some of the things that were talked about, you're going to be able to do that through artificial intelligence. If you want to see the way typeset was used, regardless of the actual story, you're going to be able to see that. The same thing with the artwork. I love what you talked about with the comics and the changing, right? Like, I'd love to talk to Walt Handelsman, the really great local political cartoonist, about that and how that's changed over time. And you can see that. And so using the technology that you guys are building, you can see that one day you'd be able to go through and kind of look at it from that lens. Or maybe there's somebody with a viewpoint you and I aren't thinking of that's going to say, if only I could go back in time and look at this lens of something. I think about Richard Campanella, the local author and professor at Tulane, who thinks about, I think he calls himself an archaeologist in terms of looking at maps, a cartographer, and being able to go back and kind of go through it and figure out what something looked like over time mm-hmm. in a neighborhood, like you're saying. That's I think the ideas are just kind of endless.
I think there are, I think there are many ideas, especially when you start to think about sort of global implications and looking at things like, wow, we could animate, once this is all scanned, we could choose, like you asked me sort of how the styles and trends shifted over time. We could do a 40-year animation of how the newspapers evolved, visually.
Right.
So there's visual perspectives of the material culture. There's that aspect of it and what that signals with technology and development. Those things are related. Like I was saying, right when photo came in at the beginning, it was amazing what they were doing with photo. And then all that kind of changes, strangely enough, like when the technology first comes in, I see like a different thing. Hmm. And then maybe it gets more acclimated, where like photography and illustration kind of merge. Or like at the beginning, I see a lot of photo where it looks like it's a piece of artwork, but if you look really closely, you realize that it's a painting that's been photographed. And that it's a photograph printed in the paper of something that was done painted or
sure.
watercolored or something.
Right.
So it's interesting to see, like, when you look at it, you're like, oh, that's a painting, but you're like, wait a second, that's actually a photograph of a painting. So it's a photo, So
right.
you think about, oh, it's wow, yeah. it's photo in the paper.
Sure.
So there's like all these interesting transitions that you see, and let alone being able to take like 40 years of boat schedules and say, like, okay, let's take this and bring this in and let's visualize this using Tableau or using some sort of like infographic thing and animate, boat schedules or being able to just imagine, like when we take and we put like a couple hundred comics right there, like together, like
sure.
in one flat file cabinet, those comics have never been next to each other ever before. Because it's always just been one every week.
Right.
So if you're trying to look at this this Irresistible Rag, which is an incredible comic, while it's questionable, but it's a cool comic from something, you know, Chris Ware or R. Crumb would love this because it's like a jazz era comic about a musician in the paper. And if you look at that and we say, okay, we can look at 250 of them, we can see an evolution of that title over the course of these X many years.
Sure.
That's only something that you're able to do if you put them all in order.
Right.
You put them in one place at one time. Otherwise, that would exist in a newspaper archive over the course of 40 years of, or sorry, that one was only 7 years, but 7 years of volumes of months.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I should have mentioned too at the start, besides NOLADNA.com, listeners can follow you guys on Twitter at New Orleans DNA and on Instagram at NOLADNA, as well as on Facebook. And I think it's a great way, like the other day for Memorial Day, you posted a clipping.
Harper's, yeah.
Yeah. And so it's if you're curious about what all this looks like beyond the pictures that we'll take and post, following you guys on social media is a great way to kind of see these snippets and how you go in the archives and tell stories about whatever the moment in time is today through the lens of the archive.
Yeah, I have a project. I can't quite announce it yet, but I'm going to start a column, and it's going to be sort of like looks through the oracular, like the idea of this is an oracle, and like there's a lot of interesting stuff that I found. Like there's an article that I'm going to write on for one of my pieces, and it's like the headline says like Ouija looks into the future of New Orleans. You know, so I'm going to do a piece on that. These real kind of like, it's so old that no one asks if it ain't there no more. Like there's no one alive to ask.
Right.
Because everyone now, that whole like idea concept is everyone's looking very much toward like the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, that I think people are looking at mostly when they say that. But I think there's another New Orleans. The pre-Fleur de Lis New Orleans, a different pre-World War II New Orleans and a pre-World War I New Orleans. And when you start to look back, you see that this city was a different city. But that it's like we still share some of the same, you know, tastes and likes. Like, I don't know if you caught that article, but Ian McNulty did a story a few months back about street food vending that I showed him this article. I was like, man, this is an article you would have wrote 100 years ago. And it was a feature story about street food vendors on Poitras. And he loved it because it was like, he's like, man, this is like totally exactly what I do as a food writer in a certain way. So he was able to go in and write about food writing as a food writer and just talk about the different things like that were like the talk of the town, like people knew the difference between the hand ground cornmeal tamales and the non-hand ground cornmeal tamales, and the way that you knew which cart had the better tamales, you saw these white napkins on the ground around the cart, and that was a sign that that was the good truck to eat at because there was all these
because other people
napkins.
Had been there, right?
And the same, I actually was in a tapas bar in Spain where the same thing happened, where people would throw their napkins after they're done eating their little snack on the ground, and the floor of the restaurant was full of these paper napkins on the ground, and it was a sign of good food. So there's like these interesting relations, like stuff like that, you know,
right.
Where there's like little pieces of culture that are like lost to time, but there's so much of that in here. There's so much of that in here, and I'm finding coverage of oysters, and I'm finding coverage of. I mean, it just goes on and on and on
right.
And on, and it's like I'm open and changing the way that I'm thinking about this, and I'm very open and interested. If someone's got project idea, you know, there's possibilities, and it's our goal now is to really like get this ramped up and get this digitized and really represent this as a gift to Louisiana, you know, like in the Gulf is like. To try to have a vision for what an archive can really be in the future. And we can do that now because it's finally at a point where all the technology is coming together. It's a really exciting time.
Well, Joseph, it's really exciting. I thank you so much for opening this up and sharing it with us and sharing it with the listeners. And hopefully through the podcast, it'll get it out to more people. And maybe people listening will have ideas and interests as well. But I can't wait to see what you continue to do with NOLA DNA and with the archive in general. So thank you, Joseph, for taking the time.
Hey, thanks so much for coming.
Hey guys, we'll put all the links as well as we're going to take a bunch of pictures and we'll put links to NOLA DNA and all the other resources online over at beyondbourbonst.com/91.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please share it with someone who loves New Orleans. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.